Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
And now our next guest, another old friend of the pod, another person who goes a long way back in the relationship with Paul McCartney. We're very fortunate to have been able to tempt him out today, because he normally spends the summer months in his study reading Russian novels and counting the days until the return of live football. I'd like you, please, to give a warm welcome, because he's shy as a rule. Would you please welcome Danny Baker? So what's in your bag, Danny?
The fee you've given me. You know that. I'm here to celebrate Paul.
It's virtually
Paul's,
empty.
At a price. It's not only Paul's today, it is Sammy Kahn, the great songwriter.
Oh, right, of course.
Hendrix played Monterey today. And on the 18th of June 1948, Columbia unveiled the new
long playing records?
That was today. The first album came out this day, 1948. And a 6-year-old Paul McCartney told them, "You're going to need two of those for an album I'm making in 20 years' time." But it is today, the first album.
So where the question we put to everybody is, when did Paul McCartney first come into your life?
It's easy. 1, 2, 3, 4! That.
All right.
My sister, who was 12 when that came out, The Perfect, she brought in our house. And from the moment you heard Paul go, 1, 2, 3, 4! That literally counted down and counted into what we now know as pop culture. And I knew it was, I'd seen them, and he was always the one you were drawn to, certainly for me. He was the best looking one, the one I most identified with as a kid. I was a good looking kid, I can't help. And you did, you just felt, at that point he was the leader of the group, and that's the voice you heard, 1, 2, 3, 4. He's also the last voice on the album, on Twist and Shout. When it finishes, dum 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 dum, bam bam blow, you hear him go, yeah! And
yes,
it's a wonderful moment. You hear him finish it. On quite a few records, you hear Paul, if you will, ejaculating like that. He does. He does. And it's because he seems to love it so. And when he finishes, you listen, that song ends, he goes, yeah! And that was the last thing they recorded for the album. And you can tell we've got it. We've got lightning in a bottle here. But the first, he came into my life with 1, 2, 3, 4, which is an incredible moment, launches pop culture. And also my sister had a massive poster. She took down Cliff and everyone, mainly Cliff, from her walls, and put up, I think Ravelli magazine, put a fold-out poster of that photo session they did on a beach somewhere.
Oh, yes.
Victorian.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And there was Paul and a donkey and all of that. And so that's my earliest memories of it. and the Beatles.
Right, so your sister was an active fan.
My sister was the girl who climbed Buckingham Palace gates, as you know.
How old were you then at that time?
I was only five or six.
Five, that's amazing.
But it was so huge in our house, you know. My brother was older than me, my sister older than me, and we should all just sit around in the bedroom. I was very much the minor part of the family, but that's the effect it had on us. And there was nothing else played. Nothing else played in the house, upstairs and downstairs, as opposed to, you know, Jeff and Andy we had earlier. My old man and my mum and dad had no real beef with pop music. They just let us get on. They didn't bother about it one way or the other. They didn't think it was, you know, they didn't like it or anything. They just thought that's their music. It was fine, but we used to play it a lot. And one by one, the singles all started coming in, and I was raised on it. And my brother had the Beach Boys, really, but my sister was the Beatles, and she was the girl who climbed Buckingham Palace gates. And it's not an apocryphal story. She really was. I called it a day. And I said, Paul's 80. She went, oh, don't say that. It's the worst thing. I mean, she wouldn't mind me saying. But no, it is. I mean, Sharon's 72 now. And I said, you met him, didn't you? She said, oh, so many times. She was right outside his house all the time. And she said, and sometimes we'd go across to Wimpole Street. She said he'd go out past us and get in the mini car and off they'd go. And we knew they was going around to Jane's house because early in the morning he was going around to her house. And she said, so we'd all go off to Wimpole Street and wait for him there. And they'd gone for breakfast, she said, or whatever. So we'd be there when they got there because they'd be half an hour or something getting breakfast. And she said, and he'd get out the car and look at us all. There's about 10 of them always. And just think, how did you do that? But they'd been to breakfast, I forget that. And I said to her, what did you say to him? She said, oh, I don't know, we just said anything and all. I said, did he talk to you? She went, sometimes. And then she paused. She went, he wasn't always that pleased to see us. But Sharon was the lightning rod, and I fortunately took up some of the sparks.
So have you met him?
Yeah, a few times. TFI Friday did a couple of three times. The first time, other than the story that everybody's got, the generic story of seeing him going through Soho Square, and there's across Soho Square where the post office used to be. What's the name of that street that runs up to the? Where that street is across the road from Oxford Street, and there's a music shop, guitar shop. And I remember looking in, my mate liked guitars, and a lot of us looking in there.
Ivan Meyrant's guitars.
There you go. And we were all looking in the window. There was loads of people looking in the window. And from behind us, a voice said, I'd buy one of those if I could afford it. And we looked round, and like you described, he's made an art. And I keep walking, but turning round. So we walk past, and do that.
There's a Pizza Express on the corner of Dean Street, just round the corner from his office.
Yeah.
On a corner. And I've been in there when it's been full at lunchtime, and he's gone past the window. And pretty much the whole restaurant just stood up and applauded. And he's gone round, waving all the way round.
You know? Well, when he was on TFI, I can't remember what single it was. He was promoting, I can't remember what it was, but it required him to perform on his own, but with a bank of television screens behind him, bank of television screens, with him on each one playing different instruments and doing different things. It was technically very, very difficult, but that's what he was doing. And of course, TFI was live, and I used to get there about 10, 30, 11, and I went in. And I'm huge, you know, McCartney's on. And he was already there, and he was on the stage, and he was calling out technical things he wanted. And they were running through, and he was looking round at the screens and getting himself in sync and saying, you know, this one down here needs... And he was sort of directing. And then it stopped, because I stood in the empty, dark studio and watching him. And it stopped, and I've got a terrible track record of doing this, because I always find it breaks the ice most of the time. And he stopped. Okay, so... Take it back and we'll try again. And in that little gap, when he stopped talking, I went, you should have turned it in after Besame Mucho, right? That's what I said. Promise you. And he went, and we mentioned earlier, I know it's self-regarding, but there it is, you forget people see you. There's no reason I've done, you know, television shows of varying quality by that point. And he went like that. And he went, hey, And he called my name. It was Tony Baker, right? And I said, yeah. And he went, hey, Besame Mucho, don't knock that. And he started playing it. Yeah. Besame, Besame Mucho. He started playing it. So that was the one of the times I met him. He did tee up twice. And the second time, he stayed around and had a drink afterwards. He a good drink afterwards. He drank nothing but champagne. We kept that little bar we used to film in afterwards. In fact, I've got drunk with George and Ringo and Paul. And when I met John in New York, I was extraordinarily drunk. I think I was drunk enough for both of us. So I've been drunk with all the Beatles in my head. but certainly he did, yeah. And sitting there, just trying to say, yeah, this is all cool. You're Paul McCartney, and he's just sitting there. He likes to put his hands behind his head and stretch out when he's talking. And he does listen rather than join in the conversation too much, I found.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
A record. We should have a record, shouldn't we? One record that would explain Paul McCartney to a Martian.
Well, there's the right answer and there's my answer. The right answer is Yesterday, but it's not the smart answer, but the right answer is Yesterday. It's just about the perfect song. It's, as we all know, it's been recorded more than anything else. It's Yesterday. It's this monolithic song that's fits in all periods. It's like a madrigal from Broadway. You know, it's everything. And you could say that's what human music is like. You could make any arrangement of that with any kind of palm orchestra, string orchestra, you can do what you want with that. That's it's all there. Because he wouldn't know anything else about Paul McCartney, but Yesterday, okay. And that's as good an example of all kinds of music across it. But in terms of my own choice, in the early 90s, they used to put out CD singles, and CD singles were put out in various formats to keep it selling. And there was one called Hope of Deliverance. Not his greatest track, it's pretty average McCartney track by his standards. And Hope of Deliverance came out as a single with a B-side. And then they put out Hope of Deliverance with the remix of Hope of Deliverance and the B-side. Then there'd be a vinyl version of it. And then they put out Hope of Deliverance with three extra tracks on it. And one of the extra tracks was something called Kicked Around No More. And it's one of the greatest Paul McCartney tracks, Kicked Around No More. And it only is available on this fourth edition of... He's never put it on anything else. I don't say this just to go deep cut or anything, but it is one of the most extraordinary songs. And if you could say...
Why is it so extraordinary?
It's just a great song, because it's a great, great, great Paul McCartney song. If we put it on there for people who don't know it, you'd all go, well, that should have been lead track on any album. It's just one of his great songs. It's kind of a bit during his kind of part electro thing, but it's very slow and very moody, and it's heartbreakingly beautiful. A period in his life, I think it was when... I think it was as Linda was diagnosed around that time. And it's a lyric where he says, I don't want to be kicked around no more. You know, and that's basically his voice. It's a beautiful, beautiful Paul McCartney track. And if you said to a Martian, that was put out, thrown away. He didn't make anything. He didn't think that much of this. He didn't. No. He just saw this. Oh, well, I've got that other track. Any other artist would have lived their career on it. And so you could say, what kind of talent would just throw that away? And if it's the only place you can really find it is on YouTube now. It's on this one CD single that was put out in 1992 and nowhere else. It's on no compilation. And I'll stand by it. If you listen to Kicked Around No More, it is astounding record.
But you fight the corner, don't you, for what I think a lot of people would call the corny songs that Paul McCartney has written. And rightly so.
Pete Pavidis wrote a thing yesterday and said pretty much the same thing, that all these songs that are supposed to take him down a peg or two, like the Frog Chorus and Obladi Oblada and Honey Pie, they're all absolutely stone magnificent. Yeah. Because if you're not going... no one else can do that. There's a great story of George Harrison, when he was being interviewed once, said, I'll see all these interviews with rock stars. He said, no, you know, I see Eric when he's being interviewed and people. And they say, what were you listening to growing up? And it's always Lead Belly and Blind Lemon Pugh and Muddy Waters. He said, well, in our house we had Gilly Gilly, Oss and Feather, Cats and Ellen Bogan by the Sea, and The Runaway Train came down the track and she blew. He said, they don't seem to have had that in their house. He said, yeah, when you get to be a teenager. He said, but I grew up on those songs. He said, and crap like I'm a red toothbrush, you're a blue toothbrush. Yeah. And he said, that must influence what you do. He said, but I never see that in any other interviews. McCartney puts that front and centre. You know, I'll tell you something, though, about I'm a red toothbrush, you're a blue toothbrush. It was written by Richard Sheridan. I'm a red toothbrush, you're a blue toothbrush, written by Richard Sheridan, who had a few goes at being a singer, and then found out it was more in writing, and then beyond that, more in publishing. Because George said it must have influenced the summer, even a terrible tune like that. Well, I'm a red toothbrush, you're a blue toothbrush, written by Richard Sheridan. Immediately, there's a kind of Beatles connection, because of Tony Sheridan, but there's no relation there. However, Richard Sheridan, the only thing we know for sure about him, that wasn't his real name. He changed his name lots of times. He was actually born Isaac Kupnik in the East End. His parents, he was Polish. Isaac Kupnik. And once he couldn't get much by as a singer, he started writing, and then him and his partner, who was, I'll give you his name in a minute, they said, we're going to publishing, and he changed his name to Dick James.
Oh, of course.
And Dick James wrote, I'm a red toothbrush, you're a blue toothbrush. George Harrison doesn't know this. George, not only did he influence you, he owns you. And that's what he did. His partner was Stanley Braun. Eleanor Braun, of course, was in Help. Max Bygraves sang, I'm a pink toothbrush, you're a blue toothbrush. And Max said, people hate that song. They always tell me they hate that song. But it sold millions. Not records, toothbrushes, right? That's what he used to say. Good old Max, that's what he said. Anyway, and Max, of course, was the compere of the night the Royal Variety Performance when they said, rattle your jewellery. Everything is connected. But McCartney never forgot that. And he left himself open to every influence he had. And thank God, the Beatles albums are broken up, Yellow Submarine and songs like that, because he can do that, and they needed it. And if you just concentrate on one influence, what have you got? I'll tell you, the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, that's true.
But McCartney, no, really, you had diminishing returns for the first four or five albums. It's fine going to the Chicago Delta. He didn't. He went off to Disney and Tin Pan Alley. And as a kid, I used to love those tracks. You know, something like Honey Pie, When I'm 64. Brilliant. Oh, they're just absolutely wonderful.
Music Hall and the ballads
because
you say swing and jazz.
Yeah, I wrote Here, There and Everywhere, and I wrote that. The Frog Chorus, he bought the Rupert Bear back catalogue.
Yeah.
Who's he going to aim it at? You know, students? He wrote that for kids. My kids used to love that. It's the perfect song for a Rupert film. And yet people try it as a rod to beat him with.
Yes,
it's He wrote that, and it's a brilliant song.
I'll catch you out.
Yeah.
You wrote the
rod. I know.
That's right.
Oh, you wrote Hi Diddly D, An Actor's Life for Me. How can you be any good? You know, Jagger, in his best moment, God love him, most of the songwriters of the 60s, they don't have the nerve to do that. They don't have the nerve to write those, you know, sing-along songs. Paul did. I'm doing it, I've got this. Well, let's do that. Yeah. John, God love you, you don't always have to pitch him against it. He forgot how to do that. He forgot songs have a hook and a chorus and are supposed to cheer people up. And it become too great. No,
yeah, what about this business of cheering people up? Because, I think Mark touched upon it earlier, you know, that we tend to... Is it the case we tend to overvalue misery and pop music?
Oh, always. And certainly rock music does. Rock music has always done that. They see authenticity as being someone who don't smile a lot. That's it. And it's not true. I mean, you know, this new Sex Pistols film, they try and make out 1976, everyone was miserable and listening to Brotherhood of Man doing Save All Your Kisses for Me, and it was all Emerson, Lake and Palmer. No, it wasn't. You know, it wasn't. It's a 1976 in the charts was The Boys Are Back in Town, Thin Lizzy, You to Mirror Everything, The Real Thing, Young Hearts Run Free. We cannot judge history because Johnny Rotten sat in his bedroom with his thumb up his arse listening to Wayman Dawl. That's his fault. That's his fault. McCartney, and honestly, there's, of course, you know, depression gets a lot of... Of course it does, if you should. We should talk about it. But occasionally, let's hear it for the euphoric.
Yeah,
and McCartney's back catalogue has plenty. It's something for everyone, you might say.
Yeah.
And I will take even McCartney's biggest misstep, which is Give My Regards to Broad Street, over Sometime in New York City, which only a maniac could sit through. But that's not to put Paul against any. Yeah, it's absurd, this idea that he wrote these silly songs.
Is it fair to say,
he wrote some of the greatest ever made.
But is it fair to say that John Lennon without Paul McCartney didn't fare as well as
without a doubt.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that.
I mean, I doubt John had their problems and all that, and I don't think it's... Again, you don't hear any pop songs out of John out of that, and it's all gritted teeth and diminishing returns like Walls and Bridges. Mind Games, they're not great albums, but Paul just kept knocking them out there, and at least half of it would be any good. And I think, as you said in the first half, it was the best day in the Beatles' lives when McCartney said, can I join you? And I think when they broke up, you can see McCartney knows. He knows, yeah, I can go on and have a great solo career. We all can. I don't want to. I want to do this. But the rest of them are too like, oh, I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to go out there there's too much shade and not enough light, and McCartney was the light.
So that was your major takeaway from Get Back, was it?
Yeah, that and the wonderful freedom of being in a band. Then there's nobody in Get Back with a laminate on. There's no security people around. There's none of what we used to call at TFI the scribble, which is all these people with clipboards asking, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? And there's none of that. Yeah. There's people just coming and going and coming and going. It's just marking out what songwriting has always been, you know? By the way, I mentioned it's Sammy Kahn's birthday today, the great writer Sammy Kahn, who said about pop music, which he wasn't a fan of. He said, I'm not a fan of modern pop music. I mean, Sammy Kahn wrote everything, as you know, first up in the 20th century. He said, lyrically, they can't do it. In fact, I'll tell you this. I can eat alphabet soup and pass better lyrics than what I hear in the charts. it's Sammy's birthday today as well.
So is there a story that you could do, a particular McCartney story that you've always thought
I'd say no, because I wouldn't profess to know him. I got drunk with him, I'd knocked about with him, but no, I've only, like the rest of us, read all the books. In terms of my sister, again, if I come back to Sharon... I remember going to see, I saw Help 17 times. She used to take me, but she saw it 32 times. This is only in 2 weeks. She used to come out in North London, and you had to go up to North London to see it, and she had to go to every performance of that. And as you know, the girls sat in there all day and wouldn't be shifted.
Yeah.
You just watched
it. See it 2 or 3 times in a row, wouldn't you? Because you just get around.
Well, that's why they put on that film Mozambique. If you look, it was backed up by a film called Mozambique, which was a 2-hour, sweaty, dialogue-heavy story about oil corruption in Nigeria, because they thought it'd get all the girls out so they could see all the seats again, but they didn't. They just sat. They brought packed lunches, and they underestimated the nutrition of teenage girls. And I saw, that means I've seen Mozambique 17 times, right?
Yeah.
And then it came to South London, and we saw it again. But so what was it? There's 65, I'm 8, and even I knew this was dirty. When Paul shrinks, he shrinks in Help. And he goes all little, and he's got a Wrigley's wrapper around him, and he walks past a giant ashtray, and then he shrinks back. He goes back up into his suit, and he comes next to Ringo, and he's in his suit again, and he turns. He goes, "Ee, I'm all sticky." Right? And a girl went, "I'll lick it off your paw." And everyone went, "Oh, I will. And I remember thinking, I don't quite know what's going on, but it sounds filthy. My sister was like, "Oh, I'll lick it off your paw," she shouted out. Similarly, my friend Tommy Hodges was moved out of where we lived, and his parents took over a post office in Tenterden in Kent. And inevitably, one day, Paul McCartney came in, because it's not too far from Rye. And as Paul rung me up after, Tom rung me up and said, "Paul McCartney's just been in." I said, what did he buy? He said he bought a ball of string and a load of brown paper. And he said, I couldn't think what to say. So I said, wrapping something up, Paul. And he said, yeah, a dead body, right? And I went, and he said, and I laughed. And he said, he leant in and said, "It's Ringo." And he went. Now that kind of chatty story, it's just as good for me as a big biography. Ringo. And he went out.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Wrapping up dead body of Ringo.
You must have seen him play live. Have you got any?
Not many times. I got told off. I went to see him at one of his sort of private things in a little club. And I haven't been to many concerts since about 1985. And this was in the late 90s. Anyway, it was a little club over at King's Cross. And it was about 200 people there. Tiny little club, and I haven't been to a concert for so long, and immediately came on, they all got their phones out. Now, as you know, I don't have a phone, that's no big deal, but I've never seen it. I'm standing there and we're getting all this, and I'd had a couple, but I'm like my dad. I said, "Put your phones down, put them down. I started shouting all these people, and they were all like, "Put your phones down," and they did, they all put their phones down. Everyone's just lunatic. I said, "Can you believe this?" My son said, "That's what that happens there. Now that's what they do." I said, "Not here, not while we're doing this, because we can't see anything." And then this one Japanese fella put his phone up again. I said, "Put your phone down." He went, "Oh, okay, you have shouted at me enough." I probably should just chill out a little bit. So I saw him there, and the most extraordinary time, live Paul McCartney. I stood in the car park one night. I was on my way home from the West End, doing the show at BBC London, and I came up at North Greenwich car park, which is right by the O2, and I heard this distant booming version of Take It Away, and it was McCartney sound checking in the O2, and everyone was standing around in the car park. You just wanted to hear what would be next. It was very, you know, like the bootlegs we used to buy in the 70s.
Yes.
But we all stood there and thought, we're kind of getting a free McCartney thing here. And I gave it about half hour, and he was running through the set, and it was just so cool to him, just coming out the O2 and booming around the car park outside it. So I've seen him properly as well. And I know it's the other night Springsteen came on. Didn't he with him last night?
Was it
night
did before? He?
Springsteen.
Right.
But it must be so weird for Springsteen and Jagger and everyone, no matter how huge you are, even Dylan, to say, well, look how huge we are. There's Paul McCartney.
Yeah, that's different.
Paul McCartney. It'd be like, as Tony Bennett once said about Sinatra. He said, a singer like Frank only comes along once in a lifetime. Why did it have to be my lifetime?
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And I think even Dylan must think that.
Yeah, we've solicited some questions actually via Twitter for people. I don't know if these people are here. Is David Shaw here? David Shaw, who asked, I can't see anybody. What's your favourite McCartney gig that you've been to, and why? Have you got a particular favourite?
Oh God. I went to the Hammersmithonian about 12 years ago or something with my nieces. It was just brilliant because it was my nieces, and they were about 17 and 19 or whatever, and they were obsessed with the Beatles, obsessed with McCartney,
yeah,
and had decided to reenact what they thought people would have done at, or what people did at Beatles concerts in the mid-60s. So there they were in their kind of short dresses with their screaming and yelling and pulling their hair and just going absolutely mental. And I felt really proud of them, actually, because
yeah,
everyone else was much, much older and sitting there watching McCartney. And there they were just going completely bonkers, proper Beatles hysteria. And that kind of lifted it for me. And it was just really good. And I just also was stunned by the fact that from the beginning to the end, which was 2.5 hours, no support act, I think, every single song, you cannot believe what's available to play.
There's a wonderful moment in one of the live DVDs, as it was, the one that came out about 20 years ago. It's in the States, and he's running through, you know, as he can. And he does For No One. And after the initial, woo, once he starts it, the day breaks, your mind aches, you find it all. And the camera just goes slowly through the crowd, and there's a lot of boomers with their grandkids on their shoulders, and they're all gone. They've all gone.
Oh, yeah.
And in her eyes, you see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears. And they're singing along, they're trying to, but they're just gone.
Yeah.
And that's a really powerful moment.
And there's still songs that he hasn't played. He's started playing In Spite of All the Danger recently, hasn't he, I think?
I think so,
which is incredible, really. But, I mean, he's never done Oh Darling, for example. There are songs I think he's never performed live. So he's still got all that stuff in the bank.
His, like they're saying, Spinal Tap, too much perspective. Paul McCartney is now 6 years older than Bing Crosby was when he died.
Yeah.
Right.
I know. And you think Bing Crosby's the oldest person. Yeah. Bing Crosby Bing Crosby's passed at 74.
Yeah.
McCartney's now 6 years older than Bing Crosby.
Dave, your favourite?
Yeah, well, 2003, I was very... We were working on, another magazine with Paul McCartney, and he said, we're playing at Earl's Court, come, bring the family. And normally I'm the last person in the world to ever say to my children, you should go and see so-and-so or whatever. I don't like doing that at all. And we just said, does anybody want to go and see Paul McCartney? And they all pretty much straight away, yes, we want to go. And they were all kinds of ages, I don't know, 9, 14 or whatever, 18. And he just came on, it was the low goodbye and it was all that. And they were just utterly enthralled by the whole thing. And I always think it's one of the most treasured moments as a family. Because as my wife always says, the best moments in a family are when you're all together doing something you love and yet you can't talk to each other.
So that
was just the perfect memory. You know, that was a demonstration of the ability of that music to just communicate right across generations. Right.
I mean, I used to, on Radio 1 and NIMS were the days, I did quite a few times. Trip the Live Fantastic is live album. There's a version of Get Back, which starts, it just goes, whoa, whoa, yeah, yeah, whoa, whoa, yeah, yeah, yeah. And everyone starts clapping and screaming. And then the band's starting to get back. And it's quite a long lead into it. And I used to just say, just to tease people and emotionally play with them. I said, I imagine at Live Aid, Lennon hadn't been shot, and they still hadn't been back together. But at the end of Live Aid, these rumours were everywhere. I said, in that stage at Wembley, it's nighttime now, it's dark, and people are saying, we've heard, we don't know. Someone said they've seen, they're here somewhere. I said, then it's still pitch black, and the lights are gone down, everyone's screaming and shouting. And you just hear, whoa, and I start playing it. Yeah, yeah. I said, and then cameras start going near the stage. And then somebody picks out in one of the camera flashes, there's a white suit. Is that John Lennon? You know, we don't know. And then I said, the voice goes, ladies and gentlemen, the Beatle. And the lights go up, and there they are. Georgia was a man. Well, the emails and texts you said, I've had to pull a car over, I've gone. I'm in floods of tears. Don't do this. It is the most appalling trick to play on. But that is an alternative reality that they would have, and there they are. And we all know it's a good job they're not, you know. But if anyone would have pulled it together for that, he would have done. But that moment, you think, and then the lights go on, and you wouldn't be able to cope. You wouldn't be so fucking hell. You know, I could cope with, you know, Bowie coming back to life, but I couldn't cope with all the Beatles suddenly on the stage. That it would be too much of a shock.
Yeah. Well, look, that's all for the moment.
I'll move down one a little.
Danny Baker.
Thank you very much indeed, everybody. Bless you. Thank you.
You're listening to The Word Podcast, where the time is whenever you want it to be.
Thank you, Danny. We're going to bring on our fourth and final guest. We've all looked at McCartney from the perspective of people who are in his audience and people who bought his records. But our next guest had a completely different angle on it because they were fellow commercial songwriters at the same time. In his case, writing for the Yardbirds and the Hollies and obviously later on the 10cc catalogue and an enormous number of other people too. So it'd be really interesting to hear his professional take, I think, on McCartney's, well, what must have been many times an infuriating talent. So please welcome the fantastic Graham Gouldman.
Yay! Yes, indeed.
Excellent.
Good work, Graham. How are you, my friend? All yours.
Graham Gouldman, how exciting is that? Wonderful.
Lovely welcome, thank you.
So nice to see you.
A pleasure to be here.
So we should maybe start with the same four questions. We've got an enormous number of things we want to ask you about songwriting, but I mean, in terms of McCartney, I mean, when did McCartney first come into your life? Can you remember the first being aware of his existence?
Yes, I can. I used to get a magazine called Mersey Beat. And I'd heard Love Me Do and got totally enchanted by this strange bunch of people. And the first time I saw a picture of them, they were on what looked like a sort of a building site. And there were four of them. They had what would look like long hair. Probably my hair is not that long, you know, or is longer than theirs.
Is it but the anyway, one where they're leaping in midair? Or
no, they weren't leaping in midair. They were looking very serious.
Yeah.
They were all dressed differently. They had these fantastic guitars, which I'd never seen, because up to that point, we were kind of, me and my mates were sort of obsessed with Cliff and the Shadows. So everyone had Fender Stratocasters and matching guitars, but they had Gretsches and Rickenbackers and Hofner basses. So it was all really strange. And Paul was left-handed as well, so that looked different as well. And I guess I fell in love with them at that point. So that was really my first encounter with them, and Love Me Do made change my life.
And you've met him, presumably?
Oh, yeah, a few times. We had a studio in Stockport called Strawberry Studios, and Mike McGeer, who you mentioned before, was going to record an album at our studio, and Paul was going to produce it. And I remember we were in the middle of recording the Sheet Music album. This is about 1973. And like you said, and what everybody said, there's no one like Paul McCartney. And he walked through the door, and I couldn't speak. But he was absolutely charming. He's used to making people feel at ease. He's been doing it all his life, really. He was very nice. I started talking to him about strings or guitar strings or some fucking stupid.
Always an icebreaker.
I said to myself, what are you talking about? Anyway, he was lovely. From then on, we saw him a lot because we were recording the Sheet Music album, and he was coming in later in the afternoon with Mike to record the Mike McGeer album. And the studio was completely full of 10cc equipment and McCartney's equipment as well. So we used to like sort of use a bit of his gear, like we used his Mellotron and on the Wall Street Shuffle, and we used his drum kit on other tracks as well. So that album, which a lot of people think is 10cc's best album, was in a way imbued with McCartney being around. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Besides the fact that everything that we wrote was definitely Beatles influence, because I always say without the Beatles and McCartney, obviously 10cc wouldn't have existed.
So going back to your, you know, you've seen him in Merseybeat, you've heard Love Me Do, yeah, and you know, all those records, and you're in bands in Manchester at the time. Yeah. What band were you in then?
I was in a few bands. I was in a band with Kevin Godley called The Mockingbirds.
Right. Okay.
That was well pre 10cc. So that was sort of mid 60s. But yeah, during the time, so I must have been 15 or 16 when the Beatles happened. The perfect age to be open to music. I mean, I was lucky anyway to be that age, listening some sort of like from 12 years old, listening to Elvis and Little Richard and the Everly Brothers, Eddie Cochran. I mean, every one of my generation was influenced by exactly the same people, and I'm sure McCartney was as well.
Right. And so how did you, you know, what was your response to a new Beatles record? Was it raising the bar and so forth?
Yeah, it was a major event. So you're going to buy it. It doesn't matter what it is. It's the Beatles. And you listen to it the first time and think, God, it's fantastic. Then the next record would come out and you go, oh, shit, they've lost it. And then you listen to it the second time and you go, there it is. Bang.
So can you think of specific... I can just imagine you as a songwriter dissecting that thing technically and looking for McCartney's signatures that you might possibly
I hear
emulate.
McCartney's signature in a lot of things, and I have to admit that I have been inspired by his signatures. There's one thing he does for any musicians here. He'll start a song, say, things we said today, A minor. Dum, 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 dum. And then he'll go to the next part, A major. That's a really weird thing to do. So weird that I thought, I'm going to have that. And I did that in No Milk Today, has that going from the minor to the major, and then going back to the minor again. So I thought that was just so fantastic. That and a few other things.
Any more? This is fantastic.
Well... that's one of them, but...
For fear of alarming malearned friends.
I just have to say that because I grew up with the Beatles and McCartney, they run through my veins. Mm.
Yeah.
They made, I can honestly say, they made me who I am in my as a musician and songwriter. Let's not forget him as a bass player as well.
Oh. I was going to say, yes.
One of the most influential bass players of all time.
No, we were talking about this. This fascinates me, and I'm no musician at all, but Paul McCartney was made to play the bass in the Beatles. Wouldn't he? He didn't really want to do it. The rest of them wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I had a similar experience.
Is it?
You see, but like McCartney, I'm a guitarist. McCartney's a guitarist, he's a bass player, he's a drummer, you know, he plays everything as well. I just play like guitar and bass. But his influence can't be underestimated. So he's so musical, like James Jameson, who played on a lot of the Motown records. Mm. He started playing melodies, you know, and took the bass out of just playing the root notes and that a lot of bass players, and there's nothing wrong with that, but he opened up a whole new world to bass players.
But it interests me that, if this isn't too technical a question, but playing rhythm guitar, you're playing on beat and singing at the same time. Let's say you're singing. If you're playing the lead guitar, you're never going to be singing and playing the lead guitar at the same time.
Yes, you can.
You can, but it's not that often. But the bass player, in his case, is not only playing a melody, but he's playing often against the beat while singing. And if you look at those bits of footage of him playing All My Loving, whatever, he's also winking at girls in the front row. I mean, how is that possible that somebody's mind...
Bastard, that's
you know, All My Loving and I Saw Her Standing There, the bass parts alone are so high.
I know, but
as
actually,
a bass player, isn't that an astonishing achievement?
All I'll say is, I'm going to blow my own trumpet a little bit here, but The Things We Do For Love, the bass part on that is very bump. Like that, and that I sing that on stage now with 10cc, and somebody said to me, "How the hell can you do that?" But if you can do it, you can do it. So it's one of those things. It's not clever. It's just I'm sorry, I can do it. Really, you know.
So going back to throughout the 60s, you were. You were in a band, but you're also writing songs, weren't you?
Yeah.
Whereas he was kind of taking the normal songwriting role, but within the band, wasn't he? Yeah. Because he changed the business in that sense, didn't he?
He did, very much so. So before the Beatles, really, if you wanted to make a record, you go to Denmark Street, which is like Tin Pan Alley in London, and go around the publishers and say, "Have you got a song?" And that's what we did as well. And that was at the same time that the Beatles started off. And me and many other people thought, well, if they can do it, I'm going to have a go at doing it. Mm. And they really did inspire a whole generation of people that might possibly never have started writing songs at all.
Did you ever?
But they gave you courage.
Did you ever feel like putting a song in their direction? Would you ever been so bold? Did you ever think, you know what? Because I know you did the Hollies and everybody, but did you ever think, I'll put one their way?
Well, I would have loved to have done that. A funny story, my manager at the time said, I'd written a song, and he said, we should get that to the Beatles.
That's a manager. That's a good manager.
I said, I think they're all right in that department. But here's the funny thing. So Harvey said to our publisher, I've got this song, I want to get it to the Beatles. So the publisher also said that ain't going to happen. However, and this is the weird thing, the Yardbirds are supporting the Beatles in a Christmas show at the Hammersmith Odeon, and they're looking to record some outside material because they were basically doing like a lot of standard rhythm and blues stuff up to that point, but wanted to have some commercial success. He says, I'm going to play the song to them, and that became the first song that I wrote that was a hit, which was For Your Love in 1965. So in that weird sort of way, that's really sort of ridiculous suggestion started my career.
No,
I think most songwriters will tell you this, that if the song is good enough, you will remember it. So now I do it for a bit of insurance if I've come up with an idea. But generally, and I'm talking about writing something today and remembering it tomorrow in its complete form. Not necessarily, so you might not have written all the lyrics or anything, but just the like the basic melody. So if it's any good, you'll remember it. And that in its way is a sign that the song has some sort of quality. Because I'll sometimes go back to listen to bits and pieces that I've written, and I go, I know why I didn't remember it. It's not that good. So it's true.
Yeah. There's a song on, I mentioned earlier on, called Kicked Around No More, which he never did anything with, but put it out on the CD. Pretty much can't listen to it. But there's another one, which didn't even make it as far as that. It's called Evon. And again, it's only on YouTube. How it leaked out, I don't know. He's not got the words. He's la-la-ing a lot of it. It is beautiful. And it's a classic McCartney kind of song, but it's just saying... I mean, that's the thing, you know, with all due respect to one of the greats here. It's the relentlessness of his talent and how profligate. He just seems to be able to do it and do it and do it. Even on recent albums, it's polite to say, you know, Elder Statesman, oh, it's a great album. But he's genuinely you know, and they're packed with songs.
If you're a songwriter, though, you will often write because, say, you're doing an album or you're writing for a specific purpose, but quite often you get an idea and you've just got to write it. So what is going to happen to it afterwards is kind of irrelevant. It's the fact that you've got this idea for a song and you've got to get it out, and then you go, ah, that's great, or... well, it's not so great, or I'll put that on a solo album or whatever.
No. You see, he always said yesterday, he had to ask people, this is a song already, isn't it? Yes. Do you get that?
Yeah, I do get that. And I remember writing something with the late Andrew Gold, and he said to me, you've not written that. I said, I bloody have, you know. He said, it's because there are some songs that McCartney... has this quality, because I actually could talk for hours about him, but anyway. there's a quality in the song. It's almost as you're hearing it. It's almost like you know what's coming next. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a familiarity about what he can do that touches you, that's absolutely brilliant.
Well, even when he's doing other people's stuff, I mean, I hate the phrase underrated album, usually means it's no good, but you like it. But that Kiss Is on the Bottom... yeah. Which he just played again. Yeah. This thing I was saying earlier—he's never shied away, like most rock and rollers do, from sentiment and his parents' record collection. Kisses on the Bottom is absolutely beautiful, absolutely wonderfully. And to find time and also be able to say, look, you know, what I do is fine, but look at these guys—they were at it a long time before me in a different field. He's brilliant at it.
There's a song I'm always drawn to, which is Martha, My Dear.
Oh, yeah.
Which is most charming song about his dog. Musically, it's how the hell did he come up with that? The way it moves through different keys and slightly different rhythms as well. And it's a sort of song nobody else in the world would ever write it. And there's so many. It's actually not a fair question to say, what is your favourite McCartney song? Because there's so many. But as you ask, I would say that's amazing.
Is it possible to look at... you know, I've been to see bands with other musicians, and they find it very hard to see music sometimes as entertainment because they're so busy dismantling what's going on there. And I can really... I sympathise with that to some extent. But can you move... were you able to move far enough away from what McCartney's doing?
Yeah, well,
just to think this is entertaining, rather.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen... I was lucky enough to see the Beatles play, and that was... blew my head off. But McCartney...
Where was that?
It was somewhere... it was in a marquee somewhere outside of Manchester, and I can't exactly remember where it was. But because I was with a band that was with Kennedy Street, which is an agency in Manchester, and Danny Batesh, who is still our agent and runs the promoted this concert with Brian Epstein because they were very friendly. So anyway, the upshot of it was that I was right in the front, and the Beatles came on, and it was incredible. But then we saw McCartney at the Teenage Cancer Trust concert at the Royal Albert Hall a few years ago. And so to answer your question, the answer is no. When I'm watching him, I just get completely lost in the music and I'm not analysing songs at all. If I'm listening to a record, I might go, yeah, that's a good thing. Or yeah, I can talk to other songwriters about it and dissect it. But while it was actually happening and he was performing, I was lost in the music. Yeah.
Do you think he has, there are things he can get away with because he's Paul McCartney?
Yes.
Go on, give us an example.
Not on his birthday.
No, I wasn't thinking of anything particularly negative. We were talking, we were talking back there about, there's a bit in Get Back where he's writing, Hey Jude, the movement you need is on your shoulder, and I'll change that. And John says, no, you won't.
Yeah,
and it's like on your shoulder, just left there, you know what I mean? Whereas,
well, he can get away with things because he's McCartney, he can try things because he's McCartney, but the missteps he's made are so small compared to how he's enriched our lives, no doubt about it. I wasn't that enamored with his last solo album, I have to say. There was one track on it I liked, and then I found out he'd done that with George Martin many years before. When Winter Comes, it's called. It's really charming, lovely. I wasn't mad about the rest of it, but you got to forgive him, because when you love someone, you have to forgive him.
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, Graham Goldman.
Yay!
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.